2. Misery. Writing does not cause misery. It is born of misery. Montaigne. 1. Misery's Return by Paul Sheldon for Annie Wilkes. Chapter 1. Although Ian Carmichael would not have moved from Little Dunthorpe for all the jewels in the Queen's treasury, he had to admit to himself that when it rained in Cornwall, it rained harder than anywhere else in England. There was an old strip of toweling hung from a hook in the entryway, and after hanging up his dripping coat and removing his boots, he used it to towel his dark blonde hair dry. Distantly from the parlor, he could hear the rippling strains of Chopin, and he paused with a strip of towel still in his left hand, listening. The moisture running down his cheeks now was not rainwater, but tears. He remembered Geoffrey saying, "You must not cry in front of her, old man. That is the one thing you must never do." Geoffrey was right, of course. Dear old Geoffrey was rarely wrong. But sometimes, when he was alone, the nearness of misery's escape from the grim reaper came forcibly home to him, and it was nearly impossible to hold the tears back. He loved her so much. Without her, he would die. Without misery, there would simply be no life left for him, or in him. Her labor had been long and hard, but no longer and no harder than that of many other young ladies she had seen, the midwife declared. It was only after midnight, an hour after Geoffrey had ridden into the gathering storm to try and fetch the doctor, that the midwife had grown alarmed. That was when the bleeding had started. "Dear old Geoffrey," he spoke it aloud this time as he stepped into the huge and stuporously warm West Country kitchen.
"Did you speak, young sir?"
Mrs. Ramage, the Carmichael's crotchety but lovable old housekeeper, asked him as she came in from the pantry. As usual, her mob cap was askew, and she smelled of the snuff she still firmly believed, after all these years, to be a secret vice. "Not on purpose, Mrs. Ramage," Ian said. "By the sound of your caltrip and out there in the entry, you nearly drowned between the sheds and the house." "Aye, so I nearly did," Ian said, and thought, "If Geoffrey had returned with a doctor even 10 minutes later, I believe she would have died." This was a thought he tried consciously to discourage. It was both useless and gruesome. But the thought of life without misery was so terrible that it sometimes crept up on him and surprised him. Now, breaking into these gloomy meditations, there came the healthy bawl of a child, his son, awake and more than ready for his afternoon meal. Faintly, he could hear the sound of Annie Wilkes, Thomas's capable nurse, as she began to soothe him and change his napkin. "The wee bairn's in good voice today," Mrs. Ramage observed. Ian had one moment to think again, with surpassing wonder, that he was the father of a son, and then his wife spoke from the doorway. "Hello, darling." He looked up, looked at his misery, his darling. She stood lightly poised in the doorway, her chestnut hair with its mysterious deep red glints like dying embers flowing over her shoulders in gorgeous profusion. Her complexion was still too pallid, but in her cheeks Ian could see the first signs of returning color. Her eyes were dark and deep, and the glow of the kitchen lamp sparkled in each, like small and precious diamonds lying upon the darkest jeweler's felt. "My darling," he cried, and ran to her, as he had that day in Liverpool when it seemed certain that the pirates had taken her away, as Mad Jack Wickersham had sworn they would. Mrs. Ramage suddenly remembered something she had left undone in the parlor and left them together. She went, however, with a smile on her face. Mrs. Ramage, too, had her moments when she could not help wondering what life might have been like if Geoffrey and the doctor had arrived an hour later, on that dark and stormy night 2 months ago, or if the experimental blood transfusion in which her young master had so bravely poured his own life's blood into misery's depleted veins had not worked. "Oh, girl," she told herself as she hurried down the hall, "some things dinna bear thinking of." Good advice. Advice Ian had given himself. But both had discovered that good advice was sometimes easier to give than receive. In the kitchen, Ian hugged misery tightly to him, feeling his soul live and die and then live again in the sweet smell of her warm skin. He touched the swell of her breast and felt the strong and steady beat of her heart. "If you had died, I should have died with you," he whispered. She put her arms about his neck, bringing the firmness of her breast more fully into his hand. "Hush, my darling," Misery whispered, "and don't be silly. I'm here, right here. Now kiss me. If I die, I fear it will be with desire for you." He pressed his mouth against hers and plunged his hands deeply into the glory of her chestnut hair, and for a few moments there was nothing at all except for the two of them. Annie laid the 3 pages of typescript on the night table beside him, and he waited to see what she would say about them. He was curious, but not really nervous. He had been surprised, really, at how easy it had been to slip back into Misery's world. Her world was corny and melodramatic, but that did not change the fact that returning there had been nowhere near as distasteful as he had expected. It had been, in fact, rather comforting, like putting on an old pair of slippers. So his mouth dropped open, and he was frankly and honestly flabbergasted when she said, "It's not right." You don't like it?" He could hardly believe it. How could she have liked the other Misery novels and not like this? It was so Misery-esque, it was nearly a caricature. What with motherly old Mrs. Ramage dipping snuff in the pantry, Ian and Misery pawing each other like a couple of horny kids just come home from the Friday night high school dance, and... Now she was the one who looked bewildered. "Like it? Of course I like it. It's beautiful. When Ian swept her into his arms, I cried. I couldn't help it." Her eyes actually were a bit red. "And you naming baby Thomas as nurse after me, that was very sweet." He thought, "Smart, too. At least I hope so. And by the way, Toots, the baby's name started out to be Sean, in case you're interested. I changed it because I decided that was just too fucking many ends to fill in." "Then I'm afraid I don't understand." "No, you don't. I didn't say anything about not liking it. I said it wasn't right. It's a cheat. You'll have to change it." Had he once thought of her as the perfect audience? Oh, boy. I have to give you credit, Paul. When you make a mistake, you go whole hog. Constant reader had just become merciless editor. Without his even being aware that it was happening, Paul's face rearranged itself into the expression of sincere concentration he always wore while listening to editors. He thought of this as his "Can I help you, lady?" expression. That was because most editors were like women who drive into service stations and tell the mechanic to fix whatever it is that's making that knocking sound under the hood or going wonk-wonk inside the dashboard, and please have it done an hour ago. A look of sincere concentration was good because it flattered them. And when editors were flattered, they would sometimes give in on some of their mad ideas. "How is it a cheat?" he asked. "Well, Jeffrey wrote for the doctor," she said. "That's all right. That happened in chapter 38 of Misery's Child. But the doctor never came, as you well know, because Jeffrey's horse tripped on the top rail of that rotten Mr. Cranthorpe's toll gate when Jeffrey tried to jump it. I hope that dirty bird gets his comeuppance in Misery's return, Paul, I really do. And Jeffrey broke his shoulder and some of his ribs, and lay there most of the night in the rain until the sheepherder's boy came along and found him. So the doctor never came, you see?" "Yes." He found himself suddenly unable to take his eyes from her face. He had thought she was putting on an editor's hat, maybe even trying on a collaborator's chapeau, preparing to tell him what to write and how to write it. But that was not so. Mr. Cranthorpe, for instance. She hoped Mr. Cranthorpe would get his comeuppance, but she did not demand it. She saw the story's creative course as something outside of her hands, in spite of her obvious control of him. But some things simply could not be done. Creativity or the lack of it had no bearing on these things. To do them was as foolish as issuing a proclamation revoking the law of gravity, or trying to play table tennis with a brick. She really was constant reader, but constant reader did not mean constant sap. She would not allow him to kill Misery, but neither would she allow him to cheat Misery back to life. But kill her, he thought. What am I going to do? When I was a girl, she said, they used to have chapter plays at the movies, an episode a week. The Masked Avenger and Flash Gordon, even one about Frank Buck, the man who went to Africa to catch wild animals, and who could subdue lions and tigers just by staring at them. Do you remember the chapter plays? I remember them, but you can't be that old, Annie. You must have seen them on TV or had an older brother or sister who told you about them. At the corners of her mouth, dimples appeared briefly in the solidity of flesh and then disappeared. Go on with you, you fooler. I did have an older brother, though, and we used to go to the movies every Saturday afternoon. That was in Bakersfield, California, where I grew up. While I always used to enjoy the newsreel and the color cartoons and the feature, what I really looked forward to was the next installment of the chapter play. I'd find myself thinking about it at odd moments all week long. If a class was boring, or if I had to babysit Mrs. Kremet's four brats downstairs, I used to hate those little brats. Annie lapsed into a moody silence, staring into the corner. She had become unplugged. It was the first time this had happened in some days, and he wondered uneasily if it meant she was slipping into the lower part of her cycle. If so, he had better batten down his hatches. At last she came out of it, as always with an expression of faint surprise, as if she had not really expected the world to still be here. Rocket Man was my favorite. There he would be at the end of Chapter 6, deaf in the sky, unconscious while his plane went into a power drive. Or at the end of Chapter 9, Fiery Doom, he'd be tied to a chair in a burning warehouse. Sometimes it was a car with no brakes, sometimes poison gas, sometimes electricity. Annie spoke of these things with an affection which was bizarre in its unmistakable genuineness. Cliffhangers, they call them, he ventured. She frowned at him. I know that, Mr. Smart Guy. Gosh, sometimes I think you must believe I'm awful stupid. I don't, Annie, really. She waved a hand at him impatiently, and he understood it would be better, today at least, not to interrupt her. It was fun to try and think how he would get out of it. Sometimes I could, sometimes I couldn't. I didn't really care as long as they played fair. The people who made the story. She looked at him sharply, to make sure he was taking the point. Paul thought he could hardly have missed it. Like when he was unconscious in the airplane. He woke up, and there was a parachute under his seat. He put it on and jumped out of the plane, and that was fair enough. Thousands of English comp teachers would disagree with you, my dear, Paul thought. What you're talking about is called a deus ex machina, the god from the machine, first used in Greek amphitheaters. When the playwright has got his hero into an impossible jam, this chair decked with flowers came down from overhead. The hero sat down in it and was drawn up out of harm's way. Even the stupidest swain could grasp the symbolism. The hero had been saved by God. But the deus ex machina, sometimes known in the technical jargon as the old parachute under the airplane seat trick, finally went out of vogue around the year 1700. Except, of course, for such arcana as the Rocket Man serials and the Nancy Drew books. I guess you missed the news, Annie. For one gruesome, never-to-be-forgotten moment, Paul thought he was going to have a laughing fit. Given her mood this morning, that would almost surely have resulted in some unpleasant and painful punishment. He raised a hand quickly to his mouth, pasting it over the smile trying to be born there, and manufactured a coughing fit. She thumped him on the back hard enough to hurt. Better? Yes, thanks. Can I go on now, Paul, or were you planning to have a sneezing fit? Should I get the bucket? Do you feel as though you might have to vomit a few times? No, Annie. Please go on. What you're saying is fascinating. She looked a little mollified. Not much, but a little. When he found that parachute under the seat, it was fair. Maybe not all that realistic, but fair. He thought about this, startled. Her occasional sharp insights never failed to startle him, and decided it was true. Fair and realistic might be synonyms in the best of all possible worlds, but if so, this was not that world.
But you take another episode, she said, and this is exactly what's wrong with what you wrote yesterday, Paul, so listen to me.
I'm all ears. She looked at him sharply to see if he was joking. His face, however, was pale and serious, very much the face of a conscientious student. The urge to laugh had dissipated when he realized that Annie might know everything about the Deus Ex Machina except the name.
All right, she said. This was a no-breaks chapter. The bad guys put Rocket Man, only it was Rocket Man in his secret identity, into a car that didn't have any brakes. And then they welded all the doors shut. And then they started the car rolling down this twisty-turny mountain road. I was on the edge of my seat that day, I can tell you.
She was sitting on the edge of his bed. Paul was sitting across the room in the wheelchair. It had been 5 days since his expedition into the bathroom and the parlor, and he had recuperated from that experience faster than he would ever have believed. Just not being caught, it seemed, was a marvelous restorative. She looked vaguely at the calendar where the smiling boy rode his sled through an endless February.
So there was poor old Rocket Man stuck in that car without his rocket pack or even his special helmet with the one-way eyes, trying to steer and stop the car and open the side door all at the same time. He was busier than a one-armed paper hanger, I can tell you.
Yes, Paul could suddenly see it. And in an instinctive way, he understood exactly how much a scene, absurdly melodramatic as it might be, could be milked for suspense. The scenery, all of it canted at an alarming downhill angle, rushing by. Cut to the brake pedal, which sinks bonelessly to the mat where the man's foot, he saw the foot clad in a 1940s-style air shoe, stomps on it. Cut to his shoulder, hitting the door. Cut to the outside reverse, showing us an irregular bead of solder where the door has been sealed shut. Stupid, sure, not a bit literary. But you could do things with it. You could speed up pulses with it. No Chivas Regal here. This was the fictional equivalent of Backwoods Popskull.
So then you saw that the road just ended at this cliff, she said. And everyone in the theater knew that if Rocket Man didn't get out of that old Hudson before it got to the cliff, he was a gone goose, oh boy. And here came the car, with Rocket Man still trying to put on the brakes or bash the door open. And then, over it went. It flew out into space, and then it went down. It hit the side of the cliff about halfway down and burst into flames. And then it went into the ocean. And then this ending message came up on the screen. It said, Next week, chapter 11. The dragon flies.
She sat on the edge of the bed, hands tightly clasped together, her large bosom rising and falling rapidly.
Well, she said, not looking at him, only at the wall. After that, I hardly saw the movie. I didn't just think about Rocket Man once in a while that next week. I thought about him all the time. How could he have gotten out of it? I couldn't even guess. Next Saturday, I was standing in front of the theater at noon, although the box office didn't open until 1:15, and the movie didn't start until 2. But, Paul, what happened? Well, you'll never guess.
Paul said nothing, but he could guess. He understood how she could like what he had written and still know it was not right. Know it and say it, not with an editor's sometimes untrustworthy literary sophistication, but with constant readers' flat and uncontradictable certainty. He understood and was amazed to find he was ashamed of himself. She was right. He had written a cheat. The new episode always started with the ending of the last one. They showed him going down the hill. They showed the cliff. They showed him banging on the car door, trying to open it. Then, just before the car got to the edge, the door banged open, and out he flew onto the road. The car went over the cliff, and all the kids in the theater were cheering because Rocket Man got out. But I wasn't cheering, Paul. I was mad. I started yelling. That isn't what happened last week. That isn't what happened last week. Annie jumped up and began to walk rapidly back and forth in the room, her head down, her hair falling in a frizzy cowl about her face, smacking one fist steadily into her other palm, eyes blazing.
My brother tried to make me stop, and when I wouldn't, he tried to put his hand over my mouth to shut me up, and I bit it. And I went on yelling, "This isn't what happened last week! Are you all too stupid to remember?" Did you all get amnesia? And my brother said, "You're crazy, Annie," but I knew I wasn't. And the manager came and said if I didn't shut up, I was going to have to leave. And I said, "You bet I'm going to leave, because that was a dirty cheat. That wasn't what happened last week."
She looked at him, and Paul saw clear murder in her eyes.
"He didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car. It went over the edge, and he was still inside it. Do you understand that?"
"Yes," Paul said.
"Do you understand that?"
She suddenly leaped at him with that limber ferocity, and although he felt certain she meant to hurt him as she had before, possibly because she couldn't get at the dirty birdie of a scriptwriter who had cheated Rocket Man out of the Hudson before it went over the cliff, he did not move at all. He could see the seeds of her current instability in the window of past she had just opened for him, but he was also awed by it. The injustice she felt was, in spite of its childishness, completely, inarguably real. She didn't hit him. She seized the front of the robe he was wearing and dragged him forward until their faces were nearly touching.
"Do you?"
"Yes, Annie, yes." She stared at him, that furious black gaze, and must have seen the truth in his face, because after a moment she slung him contemptuously back in the chair. He grimaced against the thick, grinding pain, and after a while it began to subside. "Then you know what is wrong," she said. "I suppose I do. Although I'll be goddamned if I know how I'm going to fix it." And that other voice returned at once. "I don't know if you'll be damned by God or saved by him, Polly. But one thing I do know. If you don't find a way to bring Misery back to life, a way she can believe, she's going to kill you."
"Then do it,"
she said curtly, and left the room. Paul looked at the typewriter. The typewriter was there. Ends. He had never realized how many ends there were in an average line of type. "I thought you were supposed to be good," the typewriter said. His mind had invested it with a sneering and yet callow voice, the voice of a teenage gunslinger in a Hollywood Western, a kid intent on making a fast reputation here in Deadwood. "You're not so good. Hell, you can't even please one crazy overweight nurse. Maybe you broke your writing bone in that crash, too. Only that bone isn't healing." He leaned back as far as the wheelchair would allow and closed his eyes. Her rejection of what he had written would be easier to bear if he could blame it on the pain, but the truth was that the pain had finally begun to subside a little. The stolen pills were safely tucked away between the mattress and the box spring. He had taken none of them. Knowing he had put them aside, a form of Annie insurance, was enough. She would find them if she took it into her head to turn the mattress, he supposed, but that was a chance he was prepared to take. There had been no trouble between them since the blow-up over the typewriter paper. His medication came regularly, and he took it. He wondered if she knew he was hooked on the stuff. "Hey, come on now, Paul. That's a bit of a dramatization, isn't it?" No, it wasn't. 3 nights ago, when he was sure she was upstairs, he had sneaked one of the sample boxes out and had read everything on the label, although he supposed he had read everything he needed when he saw what Novril's principal ingredient was. Maybe you spelled relief, R-O-L-A-I-D-S, but you spelled Novril, C-O-D-E-I-N-E. "The fact is, you're healing up, Paul. Below the knees, your legs look like a 4-year-old stick drawing, but you are healing up. You could get by on aspirin or Imprin now. It's not you that needs the Novril. You're feeding it to the monkey." He would have to cut down, have to duck some of the caps. Until he could do that, she would have him on a chain as well as in a wheelchair, a chain of Novril capsules. "Okay. I'll duck one of the 2 capsules she gives me every other time she brings them. I'll put it under my tongue when I swallow the other one, and stick it under my mattress with the other pills when she takes the drinking glass out. Only not today. I don't feel ready to start today. I'll start tomorrow." Now in his mind he heard the voice of the Red Queen lecturing Alice. "Down here we got our act clean yesterday, and we plan to start getting our act clean tomorrow. But we never clean up our act. today.
Oh-ho, Polly, you're a real riot, the typewriter said in the tough Gunsel's voice he had made up for it. Us dirty birdies are never all that funny, but we never stop trying. You have to give us that, he muttered. Well, you better start thinking about all the dope you're taking, Paul. You better start thinking about it very seriously.
He decided suddenly on the spur of the moment that he would start dodging some of the medication as soon as he got a first chapter that Annie liked on paper, a chapter which Annie decided wasn't a cheat. Part of him, the part that listened to even the best, fairest editorial suggestions with ill grace, protested that the woman was crazy, that there was no way to tell what she might or might not accept, that anything he tried would only be a crapshoot. But another part, a far more sensible part, disagreed. He would know the real stuff when he found it. The real stuff would make the crap he had given Annie to read last night, the crap it had taken him 3 days and false starts without number to write, look like a dog turd sitting next to a silver dollar. Hadn't he known it was all wrong? It wasn't like him to labor so painfully, nor to half fill a wastebasket with random jottings or half pages, which ended in lines like, misery turned to him, eyes shining, lips murmuring the magic words, oh, you numb shithead, this isn't working at all. He had chalked it off to the pain and to being in a situation where he was not just writing for his supper, but for his life. Those ideas had been nothing but plausible lies. The fact was, things had gone dry. The work had gone badly because he was cheating, and he had known it himself. Well, she saw through you, shit for brains, the typewriter said in its nasty, insolent voice. Didn't she? So what are you going to do now? He didn't know, but he supposed he would have to do something and in a hurry. He hadn't cared for her mood this morning. He supposed he should count himself lucky that she hadn't rebroken his legs with a baseball bat or given him a battery acid manicure, something similar to indicate her displeasure with the way he'd begun her book. Such critical responses were always possible, given Annie's unique view of the world. If he got out of this alive, he thought he might drop Christopher Hale a note. Hale reviewed books for the New York Times. The note would say, whenever my editor called me up and told me you were planning to review one of my books, Daily Times, you gave me some good ones, Chris, old buddy, but you also torpedoed me more than once, as you well know. Anyway, I just wanted to tell you to go ahead and do your worst. I've discovered a whole new critical mode, my friend. We might call it the Colorado Barbecue and Floor Bucket School of Thought. It makes the stuff you guys do look about as scary as a ride on the Central Park carousel. This is all very amusing, Paul. Writing critics little B.A. do in one's head is always good for a giggle. But you really ought to find yourself a pot and get it boiling, don't you think? Yes. Yes, indeed. The typewriter sat there, smirking at him. I hate you, Paul said morosely, and looked out the window. The snowstorm to which Paul had awakened the day after his expedition to the bathroom had gone on for 2 days. There had been at least 18 inches of new fall and heavy drifting. By the time the sun finally peered through the clouds again, Annie's Cherokee was nothing but a vague hump in the driveway. Now, however, the sun was out again, and the sky was brilliant once more. That sun had heat as well as brilliance. He could feel it on his face and hands as he sat there. The icicles along the barn were dripping again. He thought briefly of his car in the snow, and then picked up a piece of paper and rolled it into the Royal. He typed the words Misery's Return in the upper left-hand corner, the number 1 in the upper right. He banged the carriage return lever 4 or 5 times, centered the carriage, and typed Chapter 1. He hit the keys harder than necessary, so she would be sure to hear he was typing something at least. Now there was all this white space below Chapter 1, looking like a snowbank into which he could fall and die, smothered in frost. Africa. As long as they played fair. That bird came from Africa. There was a parachute under his seat. Africa. Now I must rinse. He was drifting off and knew he shouldn't. If she came in here and caught him cooping instead of writing, she would be mad. But he let himself drift away. He was not just dozing. He was, in an odd way, thinking, looking,
searching. Searching for what, Polly? But that was obvious. The plane was in a power dive. He was searching for the parachute under the seat. Okay? Fair enough? Fair enough. When he found the parachute under the seat, it was fair. Maybe not all that realistic, but fair. For a couple of summers, his mother had sent him to a day camp at the Malden Community Center. And they had played this game. He sat in a circle, and the game was like Annie's chapter plays. And he almost always won. What was that game called? He could see 15 or 20 little boys and girls sitting in a circle in one shady corner of a playground, all of them wearing Malden Community Center T-shirts, all listening intently as the counselor explained how the game was played. Can You? The name of that game was Can You? And it really was just like the Republic cliffhangers. The game you played then was Can You, Polly? And that's the name of the game now, isn't it? Yes. He supposed it was. In Can You, the counselor would start a story about this guy named Careless Corrigan. Careless was lost in the trackless jungles of South America. Suddenly he looks around and sees there are lions behind him. Lions on either side of him. And by God, lions ahead of him. Careless Corrigan is surrounded by lions, and they're starting to move in. It's only 5 in the afternoon, but that is no problem for these kiddies. As far as South American lions are concerned, that dinner at 8 shit is for goofballs. The counselor had had a stopwatch, and Paul Sheldon's dozing mind saw it with brilliant clarity, although he had last held its honest silver weight in his hand more than 30 years ago. He could see the fine copper plate of the numbers, the smaller needle at the bottom which recorded tenths of seconds. He could see the brand name printed in tiny letters. Annex. The counselor would look around the circle and pick one of the day campers. Daniel, he would say. Can you? The moment Can You was out of his mouth, the counselor would click the stopwatch into motion. Daniel then had exactly 10 seconds to go on with the story. If he did not begin to speak during those 10 seconds, he had to leave the circle. But if he got Careless away from the lions, the counselor would look at the circle again and ask the game's other question. One that recalled his current situation clearly to mind again. This question was, did he? The rules for this part of the game were Annie's exactly. Realism was not necessary. Fairness was. Daniel could say, for instance, luckily, Careless had his Winchester with him and plenty of ammo, so he shot 3 of the lions and the rest ran away. In a case like that, Daniel did. He got the stopwatch and went on with the story, ending his segment with Careless up to his hips in a pool of quicksand or something. And then he would ask someone else if he or she could, and bang down the button on the stopwatch. But 10 seconds wasn't long, and it was easy to get jammed up, easy to cheat. The next kid might well say something like, just then this great big bird, an Andean vulture, I think, flew down. Careless grabbed its neck and made it pull him out of that quicksand. When the counselor asked, did she? You raised your hand if you thought she had, left it down if you thought she had blown it. In the case of the Andean vulture, the kid would almost surely have been invited to leave the circle. Can you, Paul? Yeah. That's how I survive. That's how come I'm able to maintain homes in both New York and L.A., and more rolling iron than there is in some used car lots. Because I can. And it's not something to apologize for, goddammit. There are lots of guys out there who write a better prose line than I do, and who have a better understanding of what people are really like and what humanity is supposed to mean. Hell, I know that. When the counselor asks did he about those guys, sometimes only a few people raise their hands, but they raise their hands for me or for misery, and in the end I guess they're both the same. Can I? Yeah, you bet I can. There's a million things in this world I can't do. Couldn't hit a curveball even back in high school. Can't fix a leaky faucet. Can't roller skate or make an F chord on the guitar that sounds like anything but shit. I've tried twice to be married and couldn't do it either time. But if you want me to take you away, to scare you or involve you or make you cry or grin, yeah, I can. I can bring it to you and keep bringing it to you until you holler uncle. I am able. I can.
typewriter's insolent gunslinger voice whispered into this deepening dream.
What we got here, friends, is a lot of two things. Big talk and white space.
Can you?
Yes.
Yes. Did he?
No. He cheated. In Misery's Child, the doctor never came. Maybe the rest of you forgot what happened last week, but the stone idol never forgets. Paul has to leave the circle. Pardon me, please. Now I must rinse. Now I must... rinse, he muttered, and slid over to the right. This dragged his left leg slightly askew, and the bolt of pain in his crushed knee was enough to wake him up. Less than 5 minutes had gone by. He could hear Annie washing dishes in the kitchen. Usually she sang as she did her chores. Today she was not singing. There was only the rattle of plates and the occasional hiss of rinse water. Another bad sign. Here's a special weather bulletin for residents of Sheldon County. A tornado watch is in effect until 5 p.m. tonight. I repeat, a tornado watch. But it was time to stop playing games and get down to business. She wanted Misery back from the dead, but it had to be fair. Not necessarily realistic, just fair. If he could do it this morning, he could just maybe, he could just derail the depression he sensed coming on before it could get a real start. Paul looked out the window, his chin on his palm. He was fully awake now, thinking fast and hard, but not really aware of the process. The top two or three layers of his conscious mind, which dealt with such things as when he had last shampooed, or whether or not Annie would be on time with his next dope allotment, seemed to have departed the scene entirely. That part of his head had quietly gone out to get up a Stramion rye or something. There was sensory input, but he was not doing anything with it, not seeing what he was seeing, not hearing what he was hearing. Another part of him was furiously trying out ideas, rejecting them, trying to combine them, rejecting the combinations. He sensed this going on, but had no direct contact with it and wanted none. It was dirty down there in the sweatshops. He understood what he was doing now as trying to have an idea. Trying to have an idea wasn't the same as getting an idea. Getting an idea was a more humble way of saying, I am inspired, or Eureka, my muse has spoken. The idea for fast cars had come to him one day in New York City. He had gone out with no more in mind than buying a VCR for the townhouse on 83rd Street. He had passed a parking lot and had seen an attendant trying to jimmy his way into a car. That was all. He had no idea if what he had seen was licit or illicit, and by the time he had walked another two or three blocks, he no longer cared. The attendant had become Tony Bonassaro. He knew everything about Tony but his name, which he later plucked from a telephone book. Half the story existed full-blown in his mind, and the rest was rapidly falling into place. He felt jivey, happy, almost drunk. The muse had arrived, every bit as welcome as an unexpected check in the mail. He had set out to get a video recorder and had gotten something much better instead. He had gotten an idea. This other process, trying to have an idea, was nowhere near as exalted or exalting, but it was every bit as mysterious, and every bit as necessary. Because when you were writing a novel, you almost always got roadblocked somewhere, and there was no sense in trying to go on until you had an idea. His usual procedure, when it was necessary to have an idea, was to put on his coat and go for a walk. If he didn't need to have an idea, he took a book when he went for a walk. He recognized walking as good exercise, but it was boring. If you didn't have someone to talk to while you walked, a book was a necessity. But if you needed to have an idea, boredom could be to a roadblocked novel what chemotherapy was to a cancer patient. Halfway through Fast Cars, Tony had killed Lieutenant Gray when the lieutenant tried to slap the cuffs on him in a Times Square movie theater. Paul wanted Tony to get away from murder, for a while anyway, because there could be no third act with Tony sitting in the cooler. Tony could not simply leave Gray sitting in a movie theater with a haft of a knife sticking out of his left armpit, because there were at least three people who knew Gray had gone to meet Tony. Body disposal was the problem, and Paul didn't know how to solve it. It was a roadblock. It was the game, It was careless. Just kill this guy in a Times Square movie theater. Now he's got to get the body back to his car without anyone saying, hey, mister, is that guy as dead as he looks, or did he just pitch a fit or something? If he gets Gray's corpse back to the car, he can drive it to Queens and dump it in this abandoned building project he knows about. Polly, can you? There was no 10-second deadline, of course. He'd had no contract for the book, had written it on spec, and hence there was no delivery date to think about. Yet there was always a deadline, a time after which you had to leave the circle, and most writers knew it. If a book remained roadblocked long enough, it began to decay, to fall apart. All the little tricks and illusions started to show. He had gone for a walk, thinking of nothing on top of his mind, the way he was thinking of nothing on top right now. He had walked 3 miles before someone set up a flare from the sweatshops down below. Suppose he starts a fire in the theater. That looked like it might work. There was no sense of giddiness, no true feeling of inspiration. He felt like a carpenter looking at a piece of lumber that might do the job. He could set a fire in the stuffing of the seat next to him. How's that? Goddamn seats in those theaters were always torn up. There'd be smoke, lots of it. He could hold off leaving as long as possible, then drag Gray out with him. He can pass Gray off as a smoke inhalation victim. What do you think? He had thought it was okay. Not great, and there were plenty of details still to be worked out, but it looked okay. He'd had an idea. The work could proceed. He'd never needed to have an idea to start a book, but he understood instinctively that it could be done. He sat quietly on the chair, chin on hand, looking out at the barn. If he'd been able to walk, he would have been out there in the field. He sat quietly, almost dozing, waiting for something to happen, really aware of nothing at all except that things were happening down below, that whole edifices of make-believe were being erected, judged, found wanting, and torn down again in the wink of an eye. 10 minutes passed. 15. Now she was running the vacuum cleaner in the parlor, but still not singing. He heard it, but did nothing with the hearing of it. It was unconnected sound which ran into his head and then out again like water running through a flume. Finally, the guys down below shot up a flare as they always eventually did. Poor buggers down there never stopped busting their balls, and he didn't envy them one little bit. Paul sat quietly, beginning to have an idea. His conscious mind returned. The doctor is in. And picked the idea up like a letter pushed through the mail slot in a door. He began to examine it. He almost rejected it. Was that a faint groan from down there in the sweatshops? Reconsidered. Decided half of it could be saved. A second flare. This one brighter than the first. Paul began to drum his fingers restlessly on the windowsill. Around 11 o'clock he began to type. This went very slowly at first. Individual clacks followed by spaces of silence, some as long as 15 seconds. It was the oral equivalent of an island archipelago seen from the air, a chain of low humps broken by broad swaths of blue. Little by little the spaces of silence began to shorten, and now there were occasional bursts of typing. It would have sounded fine on Paul's electric typewriter, but the clacking sound of the Royal was thick, actively unpleasant. But Paul did not notice the Ducky Daddles voice of the typewriter. He was warming up by the bottom of the first page. By the bottom of the second, he was in high gear. After a while, Annie turned off the vacuum cleaner and stood in the doorway watching him. Paul had no idea she was there. Had no idea, in fact, that he was. He had finally escaped. He was in Little Dunthorpe's churchyard, breathing damp night air, smelling moss and earth and mist. He heard the clock in the tower of the Presbyterian Church strike 2, and dumped it into the story without missing a beat. When it was very good, he could see through the paper. He could see through it now. Annie watched him for a long time, her heavy face unsmiling, moveless, but somehow satisfied. After a while, she went away. Her tread was heavy, but Paul didn't hear that either. He worked until 3 o'clock that afternoon, and at 8 that night he asked her to help him back into the wheelchair again.
He rode another 3 hours, although by 10 o'clock the pain had begun to be quite bad. Annie came in at 11. He asked for another 15 minutes. "No, Pa, it's enough. You're white as salt." She got him into bed, and he was asleep in 3 minutes. He slept the whole night through for the first time since coming out of the gray cloud, and his sleep was for the first time utterly without dreams. He had been dreaming awake. Misery's Return by Paul Sheldon for Annie Wilkes. Chapter 1. For a moment, Jeffrey Alliburton was not sure who the old man at the door was, and this was not entirely because the bell had awakened him from a deepening doze. The irritating thing about village life, he thought, was that there weren't enough people for there to be any perfect strangers. Instead, there were just enough to keep one from knowing immediately who many of the villagers were. Sometimes all one really had to go on was a family resemblance, and such resemblances, of course, never precluded the unlikely but hardly impossible coincidence of bastardy. One could usually handle such moments, no matter how much one might feel one was entering one's dotage, while trying to maintain an ordinary conversation with a person whose name one should be able to recall but could not. Things only reached the more cosmic realms of embarrassment when two such familiar faces arrived at the same time, and one felt called upon to make introductions.
"I hope I'll not be disturbing you, sir," this visitor said.
He was twisting a cheap cloth cap restlessly in his hands, and in the light cast by the lamp Jeffrey held up, his face looked lined and yellow, and terribly worried, frightened even.
"It's just that I didn't want to go to Dr. Booking's, nor did I want to disturb his lordship. Not at least until I'd spoken to you, if you take my meaning, sir."
Jeffrey didn't, but quite suddenly he did know one thing, who this late-coming visitor was. The mention of Dr. Bookings, the C of E minister, had done it. 3 days ago, Dr. Bookings had performed Misery's few last rites in the churchyard which lay behind the rectory, and this fellow had been there, but lurking considerately in the background, where he was less apt to be noticed. His name was Coulter. He was one of the church sextons. To be brutally frank, the man was a gravedigger.
"Coulter," he said, "what can I do for you?"
Coulter spoke hesitantly.
"It's the noises, sir. The noises in the churchyard. Her ladyship rests not easy, sir, so she doesn't, and I'm afeard. I..."
Jeffrey felt as if someone had punched him in the midsection. He pulled in a gasp of air, and hot pain needled his side, where his ribs had been tightly taped by Dr. Scheinbone. Scheinbone's gloomy assessment had been that Jeffrey would almost certainly take pneumonia after lying in that ditch all night in the chilly rain. But 3 days had passed, and there had been no onset of fever and coughing. He had known there would not be. God did not let off the guilty so easily. He believed that God would let him live to perpetuate his poor lost darling's memory for a long, long time.
"Are you all right, sir?" Coulter asked. "I heard you were terrible bunged up t'other night." He paused. "The night herself died."
"I'm fine," Jeffrey said slowly. "Coulter, these sounds you say you hear, you know they're just imaginings, don't you?" Coulter looked shocked.
"Imaginings?" he asked. "Sir, next you'll be telling me you have no belief in Jesus and the life everlasting. Why didn't Duncan Fromsley see old man Patterson not 2 days after his funeral, glowing just as white as marsh fire?"
Which was just what it probably was, Jeffrey thought. Marsh fire plus whatever came out of old Fromsley's last bottle.
"And ain't half the bleeding town seen that old papist monk that walks the battlements of Ridgeheath Manor? They even sent down a couple of ladies from the bleeding London Psychic Society to look into that un."
Jeffrey knew the ladies Coulter meant. A couple of hysterical beldames, probably suffering from the alternate calms and monsoons of midlife, both as dotty as a child's draw-it-name-it puzzle.
"Ghosts are just as real as you or me, sir," Coulter was saying earnestly. "I don't mind the idea of them, but these noises are fearsome spooky, so they are, and I hardly even like to go near the churchyard. And I have to dig a grave for the little Roydman babe tomorrow, so I do."
Jeffrey said an inward prayer for patience. The urge to bellow at this poor sexton was almost insurmountable. He had been dozing peacefully enough in front of his own fire with a book in his lap when Coulter came, waking him up. And he was coming more and more awake all the time, and at every second the dull sorrow settled more deeply over him, the awareness that his darling was gone. She was 3 days in her grave, soon to be a week, a month, a year, 10 years. The sorrow, he thought, was like a rock on the shoreline of the ocean. When one was sleeping, it was as if the tide was in, and there was some relief. Sleep was like a tide which covered the rock of grief. When one woke, however, the tide began to go out, and soon the rock was visible again, a barnacle-encrusted thing of inarguable reality, a thing which would be there forever, or until God chose to wash it away. And this fool dared to come here and prate of ghosts. But the man's face looked so wretched that Jeffrey was able to control himself. Miss Misery, her ladyship, was much loved, Jeffrey said quietly.
Aye, sir, so she was.
He switched the cuff of his cloth cap to his left hand solely, and with his right produced a giant red handkerchief from his pocket. He honked mightily into it, his eyes watering. All of us sorrow at her passing. Jeffrey's hands went to his shirt and rubbed the heavy muslin wrappings beneath it restlessly.
Aye, so we do, sir. So we do.
Coulter's words were muffled in the handkerchief, but Jeffrey could see his eyes. The man was really, honestly weeping. The last of his own selfish anger dissolved in pity.
She were a good lady, sir. Aye, she were a great lady, and it's a terrible thing the way his lordship took on about it.
Aye, she was fine, Jeffrey said gently, and found to his dismay that his own tears were now close, like a cloudburst which threatens on a late summer's afternoon. And sometimes, Coulter, when someone is dear to us all, we find it hard to let that someone go, so we may imagine that they have not gone. Do you follow me?
Aye, sir, Coulter said eagerly. But these sounds, sir, if you heard them.
Patiently, Jeffrey said, what sort of sounds do you mean? He thought Coulter would then speak of sounds which might be no more than the wind in the trees, sounds amplified by his own imagination, of course, or perhaps a badger bumbling its way down to Little Dunthorpe Stream, which lay behind the churchyard. And so he was hardly prepared when Coulter whispered in an affrighted voice,
scratching sound, sir. It sounds as if she were still alive down there, and trying to work her way up back to the land of the living. So it does.
Chapter 2. 15 minutes later, alone again, Jeffrey approached the dining room sideboard. He was reeling from side to side like a man negotiating the foredeck of a ship in a gale. He felt like a man in a gale. He might have believed that the fever Dr. Scheinbone had almost gleefully predicted had come on him at last, and with a vengeance. But it wasn't fever which had simultaneously brought wild red roses to his cheeks and turned his forehead to the color of candle wax. Not fever which had made his hands shake so badly that he had almost dropped the decanter of brandy as he brought it out of the sideboard. If there was a chance, the slightest chance, that the monstrous idea Coulter had planted in his mind was true, then he had no business pausing here at all. But he felt that without a drink he might fall swooning to the floor. Jeffrey Alliburton did something then that he had never done before in his whole life, something he never did again. He lifted the decanter directly to his mouth and drank from the neck. Then he stepped back and whispered,
we shall see about this. We shall see about this, by heaven. And if I go on this insane errand, only to discover nothing at the end of it but an old gravedigger's imagination after all, I will have good man Coulter's earlobes on my watch-chain, no matter how much he loved Misery.
Chapter 3. He took the pony trap, driving under an eerie, not quite dark sky, where a three-quarters moon ducked restlessly in and out between the racing reefs of cloud. He had paused to throw on the first thing in the downstairs hall closet which came to hand. This turned out to be a dark maroon smoking jacket. The tails blew out behind him as he whipped Mary on. The elderly mare did not like the speed upon which he was insisting. Geoffrey did not like the deepening pain in his shoulder and side, but the pain of neither could be helped.
"Scratching sound, sir. It sounds as if she were still alive down there, and trying to work her way back up to the land of the living."
This by itself would not have put him in a state of near terror, but he remembered coming to Calthorpe Manor the day after Misery's death. He and Ian had looked at each other, and Ian had tried to smile, although his eyes were gem-like with unshed tears.
"It would somehow be easier," Ian had said, "if she looked more dead. I know that sounds..."
"Bosh," Geoffrey had said, trying to smile. "The undertaker doubtless exercised all his wit and..."
"Undertaker!"
Ian nearly screamed, and for the first time Geoffrey had truly understood that his friend was tottering on the brink of madness.
"Undertaker, ghoul! I've had no undertaker, and I will have no undertaker to come in and rouge my darling and paint her like a doll. Ian, my dear fellow, really you mustn't."
Geoffrey had made as if to clap Ian on the shoulder, and somehow that had turned into an embrace. The two men wept in each other's arms like tired children, while in some other room Misery's child, a boy now almost a day old and still unnamed, awoke and began to cry. Mrs. Ramage, whose own kindly heart was broken, began to sing it a cradle song in a voice cracked and full of tears. At the time, deeply afraid for Ian's sanity, he had been less concerned with what Ian said than how he had said it. Only now, as he whipped Mary ever faster toward little Dunthorpe, in spite of his own deepening pain, did the words come back, haunting in light of Coulter's tale. "If she looked more dead. If she looked more dead, old chap." Nor was that all. Late that afternoon, as the first of the village people had begun wending their way up Calthorpe Hill to pay their respects to the grieving lord, Shinebone had returned. He had looked tired, not very well himself, nor was this surprising in a man who claimed to have shaken hands with Wellington, the Iron Duke himself, when he, Shinebone, not Wellington, had been a boy. Geoffrey thought the Wellington story was probably an exaggeration, but old Shinny, as he and Ian had called him as boys, had seen Geoffrey through all his childhood illnesses, and Shinny had seemed a very old man to him, even then. Always granting the eye of childhood, which tends to see anyone over the age of 25 as elderly, he thought Shinny must be all of 75 now. He was old. He'd had a hectic, terrible last 24 hours. And might not an old, tired man have made a mistake? A terrible, unspeakable mistake? It was this thought, more than any other, which had sent him out on this cold and windy night, under a moon which stuttered uncertainly between the clouds. Could he have made such a mistake? Part of him, a craven, cowardly part, which would rather risk losing Misery forever than look upon the inevitable results of such a mistake, denied it. But when Shinny came in, Geoffrey had been sitting by Ian, who was remembering in a broken, scarcely coherent way how he and Ian had rescued Misery from the palace dungeons of the mad French Viscount Leroux, how they had escaped in a wagon load of hay, and how Misery distracted one of the Viscount's guards at a critical moment by slipping one gorgeously unclad leg out of the hay and waving it delicately. Geoffrey had been chiming in his own memories of the adventure, wholly in the grip of his grief by then, and he cursed that grief now, because to him, and to Ian as well, he supposed, Shinny had barely been there. Hadn't Shinny seemed strangely distant, strangely preoccupied? Was it only weariness, or had it been something else? Some suspicion? No, surely not. His mind protested uneasily. The pony trap was flying up Calthorpe Hill. The manor house itself was dark, but, oh, good, there was still a single light on in Mrs. Ramage's cottage. "Hup, Mary!" he cried, and cracked the whip, wincing.
Not much further, girl, and you can rest a bit. Surely, surely not what you're thinking.
But Shinny's examination of Jeffrey's broken ribs and sprained shoulder had seemed purely perfunctory, and he had spoken barely a word to Ian, in spite of the man's deep grief and frequent incoherent cries. No. After a visit which now seemed no longer than the most minimal sort of social convention would demand, Shinny had asked quietly, "Is she?"
"Yes, in the parlor," Ian had managed. "My poor darling lies in the parlor. Kiss her for me, Shinny, and tell her I'll be with her soon."
Ian had then burst into tears again, and after muttering some half-heard words of condolence, Shinny had passed into the parlor. It now seemed to Jeffrey that the old sawbones had been in there rather a long time, or perhaps that was only faulty recollection. But when he came out, he had looked almost cheerful, and there was nothing faulty about this recollection, Jeffrey felt sure. That expression was too out of place in that room of grief and tears, a room where Mrs. Ramage had already hung the black funerary curtains. Jeffrey had followed the old doctor out and spoke hesitantly to him in the kitchen. He hoped, he said, that the doctor would prescribe a sleeping powder for Ian, who really did seem quite ill. Shinny had seemed completely distracted, however.
"It's not a bit like Miss Evelyn Hyde," he said. "I have satisfied myself of that."
And he had returned to his calash without so much as a response to Jeffrey's question. Jeffrey went back inside, already forgetting the doctor's odd remark, already chalking Shinny's equally odd behavior off to age, weariness, and his own sort of grief. His thoughts had turned to Ian again, and he determined that with no sleeping powder forthcoming, he would simply have to pour whiskey down Ian's throat until the poor fellow passed out. Forgetting. Dismissing. Until now. "It's not a bit like Miss Evelyn Hyde. I have satisfied myself of that." Of what? Jeffrey did not know, but he intended to find out, no matter what the cost to his sanity might be, and he recognized that the cost might be high. Chapter 4. Mrs. Ramage was still up when Jeffrey began to hammer on the cottage door, although it was already 2 hours past her normal bedtime. Since misery had passed away, Mrs. Ramage found herself putting her bedtime further and further back. If she could not put an end to her restless tossing and turning, she could at least postpone the moment at which she began it. Although she was the most level-headed and practical of women, the sudden outburst of knocking startled a little scream from her, and she scalded herself with the hot milk she had been pouring from pot to cup. Lately, she seemed always on edge, always on the verge of a scream. It was not grief, this feeling, although she was nearly overwhelmed with grief. This was a strange, thundery feeling that she couldn't ever remember having before. It sometimes seemed to her that thoughts better left unrecognized were circling around her, just beyond the grasp of her weary, bitterly sad mind.
"Who knocks at 10?
She cried at the door.
"Whoever it is, I thank you not for the burn I've given myself. It's Jeffrey, Mrs. Ramage. Jeffrey Alliburton, open the door, for God's sake."
Mrs. Ramage's mouth dropped open, and she was halfway to the door before she remembered she was in her nightgown and cap. She had never heard Jeffrey sound so, and would not have believed it if someone had told her of it. If there was a man in all England with a heart stouter than that of her beloved my lord, then it was Jeffrey. Yet his voice trembled like the voice of a woman on the verge of hysterics.
"A minute, Mr. Jeffrey. I'm half unclad." "Devil take it," Jeffrey cried. "I don't care if you're starkers, Mrs. Ramage. Open this door. Open it in the name of Jesus."
She stood only a second, then went to the door, unbarred it, and threw it open. Jeffrey's look did more than stun her, and again she heard the dim thunder of black thoughts somewhere back in her head. Jeffrey stood on the threshold of the housekeeper's cottage in an odd, slanting posture, as if his spine had been warped out of shape by long years carrying a peddler's sack. His right hand was pressed between his left arm and left side. His hair was in a tangle. His dark brown eyes burned out of his white face. His dress was remarkable for one as careful, dandified as some would have said, about his clothing as Jeffrey Halliburton usually was. He wore an old smoking jacket with a belt askew, an open-throated white shirt, and a pair of rough serge pants that would have looked more at home upon the legs of an itinerant gardener than upon those of the richest man in Little Dunthorpe. On his feet were a pair of threadbare slippers.